one slow step at a time. In the porch, the outer door was closed but unlocked, as it probably had been since the time of Henry VIII, when the churches of England were looted and vandalized. To my left, illuminated only by the light which shone down through the stained glass windows, the carpet of the centre aisle was a ribbon of red in the moonlight. I thought again of the poem, and of the highwayman who had, at the end, been shot down like a dog on the highway. And I thought, for some peculiar reason, of the dead Mr. Corlicutt. Mr. Corlicutt, of course, had not lain in his blood on the highway with a bunch of lace at his throat, but he might as well have. It came back to me in a flash like a news reporter's camera. He had been wearing a bunch of lace at his throat, or something very much like it. The highwayman had died for love, hadn't he? To warn him that the inn was swarming with King George's men, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess, had shot herself in the breast. They had both died. Would there be another victim in Bishop's Lacey? Were Mr. Corlicutt's killers already plotting to silence someone else, someone who had loved the unfortunate organist? I moved slowly up the centre aisle, touching the ends of every row of pews with my fingertips, absorbing the security of the ancient oak. There was just enough light to make my way up the chancel steps to the organ without using the torch. Back to business, I decided. Although the wall panel was nearly invisible, Feely had opened it easily. Would I be able to find the latch? I ran my fingers over the polished wood and the carved mouldings, but they were as solid as they looked. I pressed here and there. It was no use. The face of a carved wooden imp grinned at me saucily in the shadows. I touched his puffed-out polished cheeks and gave them a twist. There was a click and the panel slid open. I stepped carefully inside. Closing the panel behind me, I switched on the torch. Praise be to Saint Tancred, the patron saint of evidence. There on the floor, in the beam of light, were Feely's footprints and my own in the dust. Nobody had walked over them. The police had seen no reason to examine the organ case. Why should they, after all? It was nowhere near the spot where Mr. Cullicutt's body had been hidden. Even Mr. Haskins hadn't been in here to extract the bat from the organ pipe. I could spot the prints of his gravedigger boots a mile away, which meant, most likely, that the bat's carcass was still at the bottom of the 16-foot diapason. Rest in peace, little creature, I thought. The thing had got in through the coal hole, I supposed, during the nighttime comings and goings of whoever had stuffed Mr. Corlicutt into the wall of the crypt. I gave the pipe a tap with my knuckles, but nothing stirred. The bat was almost certainly dead. My torch illuminated a couple of fresh gouges in the wood of the organ frame. I dropped to my knees for a closer look. Yes, there could be no doubt about it. Crikey! I nearly leapt out of my skin as in the far corner the wind chest gave out a dry wheeze. The tombstone of Hezekiah Whitefleet had settled, forcing wind into the organ's works. There was also a hissing behind me. I swung round the torch's beam and at once spotted the source of the noise. Set into the wooden ductwork was a round, drilled hole, slightly smaller in diameter than a lead pencil, and it was through this that the air was hissing. On the floor, directly beneath it, was a dried red stain. As I took a step forward, something crunched under the sole of my shoe. I knew, even without looking, that it was glass. My own laboratory work had made me quite familiar with the principle of the manometer, that liquid-filled U-shaped glass tubing which was used to measure air pressure. It made good sense that the organ would have been fitted with such a device to measure the pressure from the wind chest. The tube, marked in inches, would, until recently, have been partially filled with coloured alcohol, its level giving the required reading, very much like an outdoor thermometer. All that now remained of the manometer, besides the gritty glass crumbs on the floor, was the jagged ring of hollow glass where it had been snapped off level with its wooden socket. The rest of the glass tubing, if I were any judge at all, I had seen clutched in the hand of the late Mr. Collicat. It was here on this spot, in the very heart of the great organ that he had loved and played, that the organist met his death. I was sure of it. I didn't have a pocket knife to scratch away a sample of the red-coloured stain, but that wasn't much of a problem. To avoid contaminating it with my fingers, I would unscrew the back of the torch and use the tin casing as a makeshift scraper. It was only as I pointed the beam at my knees that I realized what I had done to my clothing. My best black coat looked as if I had been rolled in ashes. It was streaked with slime from the grave, caked with mud from the tunnel, and covered over with a layer of dust. Another item to be consigned to the flames. My face, I supposed, was no better. I ran the back of my hand across my forehead, and it came away darkened with disgusting juices. Better have a good wash up, I thought. I hoped there was a source of water somewhere in the church. If so, and given the number of hours until daylight, I might even manage to make myself respectable in time for breakfast. Of course, I thought, the font. I stepped carefully out of the organ chamber and into the apse, taking care not to wipe myself against the ecclesiastical furniture. If need be, I might even make a raid on the communion wine to use as a spotting solution. I let out a dry snort at the thought of the vicar's likely reaction, the look on his face. A piercing scream shattered my thoughts. I spun round and found myself face to face with an apparition dressed all in black. My blood ran cold. It took my startled brain several seconds to recognize this seeming phantom. It was Cynthia Richardson. She had seen me come floating out of a blank wall, my clothing, if anything, more grave-stained than before. Her mouth was still hanging open from the scream, her eyes bugging out. "Hannah!" she gasped. Her eyes rolled up into her head and she crumpled to the floor as if she had been shot in the heart. My spine was suddenly a trickle of ice water. Hannah had been the name the vicar had cried out in his sleep the night he and Cynthia had been trapped by a storm at Buckshaw.
"Hannah, please, no!"
I could still hear his tortured whisper in my mind. I had wondered then who Hannah might be, and I wondered now as I stared down at the unconscious Cynthia Richardson. Unconscious? Or was she dead? Had she died of fright? People had been known to do that. I knelt down beside her and put a finger to the angle of her jaw, just as I had seen Dogger do on more than one occasion. The strong, steady pulsing was impossible to miss. I breathed a sigh of relief. I hadn't killed her after all. Next thing was to make sure that she was comfortable and breathing properly. From my Girl Guide training in first aid, I remembered that shock victims must, at all costs, be kept warm. I peeled off my heavy coat and covered her, thinking how pitifully small the woman was, scarcely bigger than me. As I listened at her mouth to the breath rushing in and out, I thought about the time Cynthia had caught me climbing the altar to scrape a sample of blue zaffre from a medieval stained glass window for chemical analysis. Cynthia had put me over her knee and spanked me on the spot, making improper use of a copy of Hymns Ancient and Modern. It was almost comical in retrospect, but not quite. I had still never completely forgiven her for the first real punishment, other than from my sisters, of course, that I had ever received in my life. Now, as I knelt beside her, I wanted to feel revenge. But I couldn't. I just couldn't. Should I stay beside her, keep watch over her until the sun came up? Perhaps I should run to Dr. Darby's house for help, or rouse the vicar from the vicarage. These thoughts were racing through my mind when there was a soft footstep behind me. I leapt to my feet and spun round. There stood the vicar, his face white as ashes. "Oh dear," he was saying, "oh dear, I feared it would come to this." Not, what are you doing creeping round the church in the middle of the night? Not, why are you crouching over my beloved wife? Not, what have you done to her? Just, oh dear, I feared it would come to this. Come to what? I wondered. And when it came to that, what was Cynthia doing creeping round the church in the middle of the night? Could it have been she who... I couldn't allow myself to complete that impossible thought. I think she fainted, I said rather stupidly, and I caught myself, incredibly, wringing my hands. This is not the first time, the vicar said, almost as if to himself, shaking his head. No, I fear it is not the first. Not knowing what to do, I stood there like a lug. Flavia, dear, he said at last, kneeling beside Cynthia's crumpled body, you must help me get her home. The words seemed odd and strained. Why not let her regain consciousness before hauling her back to the vicarage? It wasn't as if she were drunk in a public place and needed to be whisked out of sight before the parishioners found her out. Or was it? No, it couldn't be. I hadn't detected the slightest smell of alcohol, and I prided myself on my ability to sniff out the ketones. Of course, I said. The vicar lifted his wife as easily as if she were a doll and moved quickly with her down the center aisle toward the door. I followed him through the churchyard's cold, wet grass to the vicarage, glancing round to see if there were faces peering out from behind the ancient tombstones, but there were not. The intruders had made their getaway. I dashed ahead up the vicarage steps and held open the door. In the study, the vicar said, as I flicked on the dim bulb in the little foyer. The study, as usual, was a landslide of books. I shifted several stacks of tinder-dry volumes from the horsehair sofa to the floor. The same sofa, I noted, upon which Mad Meg had been stretched out at the time of the Rupert Pawson affair. The vicar arranged my coat as carefully round his wife's body, as if he were tucking a child into bed. She stirred slightly and gave out a little moan. He touched her face tenderly. Cynthia's pale eyes opened and moved uneasily from side to side. It's all right, darling, the vicar said. Everything is all right. Her eyes found his, and it was then that the miracle happened. She smiled. Cynthia Richardson smiled. I had always thought of the woman as rat-faced, although perhaps I was a little prejudiced. The fixed grin of her protruding teeth, cancelled out by a perpetual frown, gave her the look of a terrible-tempered rodent. Yet Cynthia had smiled. And to be perfectly fair, I would have to admit that her smile was of the sort that is generally described as radiant. No Madonna had ever gazed down upon her child with such a tender look. No bride had ever smiled up at her groom with such love as Cynthia Richardson gave to her husband. It almost brought tears to my eyes. Shall I run for Dr. Darby? I asked. I can be there and back in a jiff. The truth was that I wanted to leave them alone in this moment. I was an intruder. No, the vicar replied. Rest is what she needs. Look, she's already asleep. And it was true. With part of that wonderful smile lingering at the corners of her mouth, Cynthia had nodded off. A small snore confirmed it. What happened? The vicar asked rather tentatively. She must have had a shock. It's a long story, I said. Tell me, he said gently. We have all night. One of the things I love about our vicar, Denwin Richardson, is the fact that he accepts me as I am. He does not ask idiotic questions. He does not want to know, for instance, what I was doing at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, emerging, covered in grave dirt, from the panelling of his church. He does not want to know why I am not at home, tucked up into my own little bed, dreaming childish dreams. In short, he treats me as a grown-up. It is a gift to both of us. Which is why I broke my long-standing rule and not only took responsibility, but also volunteered information. I'm afraid it's my fault, I said. I gave her a start. She thought I was someone else. The vicar raised a sad eyebrow. He didn't need to do more. She said, Hannah, I told him, and then she collapsed. There was one of those long silences during which, through embarrassment, you're aching to say something, but for fear of even greater embarrassment, you don't. Hannah, he said slowly. Hannah was our daughter. I felt something horribly heavy descend upon me, as heavy as all the universe, and yet invisible. I said nothing. She died when she was 4, the vicar said. I killed her. Chapter 14. I could hardly find the breath to speak. Surely not, I managed. Another eternity passed before the vicar spoke again. 7 years ago, Christmas week, I had taken her with me to the railway station in Doddingsley to pick up the holly for the church, as I always do. Hannah loved Christmas, always wanted to be a part of everything. Someone stopped me on the platform, a former parishioner, hadn't seen her for years, wanted to wish me compliments of the season, you see, and I let go of Hannah's hand, only for a moment, you understand, but... The train. Suddenly tears were rolling down his cheeks. I watched my hand reaching for his. I shouted at her, tried to call her back. I'm sorry, I said, aware even as I spoke what useless things, really, words of sympathy are, even though they're sometimes all we have. I'm sorry, I repeated. Had she lived, the vicar said, his eyes swimming, she would have been your age. Cynthia and I often think how much you... He stopped abruptly. Cynthia and your mother were great friends, you know, Flavia. They were to become mothers at the same time. Another part of the puzzle that was Harriet fell into place. I'm sorry, I said again. I didn't know. How could you? The vicar asked. The good people of Bishop's Lacey have conspired to silence. Hannah's death is not to be spoken of. They think we don't know, you see. But we do. But you mustn't blame yourself, I blurted, filled with a rising anger. It wasn't your fault. It was an accident. The vicar gave me a sad smile, which signaled that my words changed nothing. Where is she buried? I asked with sudden boldness. I would take flowers and place them with great ceremony on the little girl's grave. I would put an end to this pathetic silence. Here, the vicar said simply, in the churchyard, close by the Cottlestone tomb. We couldn't at first afford a stone, you see. A country vicar's purse does not. And later, well, later was too late. Still, Cynthia goes there often to visit, but I'm afraid I shivered as the full horror of his words crept upon me. Their child was buried at the very spot from which Cynthia had seen me burst forth from the earth. And later, in the church. How could I ever make amends? She thought I was Hannah, I said, taking the first step. I was looking round inside the organ casing for clues. I must have seemed to her to have come through the wall. As I spoke, Cynthia gave a soft moan and rolled her head from side to side. I'm glad you were in the church, I said. I wasn't quite sure what to do.
I followed her there, the vicar said softly. I often do,
to ensure that she comes to no harm, you see. Cynthia stirred. Gently, he lifted my disgusting coat from her shoulders and handed it to me, replacing it with the afghan that was folded at the end of the sofa. I'd best be going, I said, taking the hint. As I shrugged into my coat, small clods of clay fell to the carpet. I was already at the door when the vicar spoke.
Flavia, he said.
I turned back. Yes? His eyes, still wet, met mine.
Be careful, he said.
That's another one of the things I love about Denwin Richardson. Buckshaw by moonlight was a scene from a dream. As I rode toward it along the avenue of chestnut trees, the house was half illuminated by a pale silvery light, the other half in darkness, its long black shadow crawling away across the Trafalgar lawn toward the east, as if trying to reach the safety of the distant trees. I parked Gladys against the brick wall of the kitchen garden and glanced at the upstairs windows. There were no lights and no white faces staring down at me. Perfect, I thought. I needed time to concoct a chemical cleaning solvent. I would mix something in a coal scuttle, something involving ammonia and one of the chlorine-based oxidizing agents. Or perhaps petrol. I could easily siphon a gallon from Harriet's Phantom too. I would ball up my filthy coat, immerse it for half an hour, then hang it out the window of my laboratory to dry in the wind. It would be as spotless and fresh-smelling as if it had been dry-cleaned by Armfields in Belgravia. As I opened the door and stepped into the kitchen, I realized how hungry I was. I hadn't eaten for ages, and my stomach was hanging against my spine like an empty saddlebag. I would cut some bread from the pantry and take it upstairs to toast over the open flame of a Bunsen burner. I was halfway across the kitchen when a solemn voice, like the tolling of a passing bell, said,
Flavia.
It was Father. At first I hardly recognized him. He was seated at the table in dressing gown and slippers. I had never before seen him dressed in anything other than his usual outfit of shirt, tie, vest, jacket, trousers, and mirror-polished boots. I was at the church, I began, hoping to gain some advantage, even though I couldn't imagine what it was. Talking to the vicar, I added lamely.
I'm quite aware of that, he said.
Aware? Had the vicar turned rat on me?
The Chancellor telephoned.
I could hardly believe it. Father forbade use of the instrument, as he called it, except in the most dire emergency. He felt about the telephone the way a condemned man feels about the scaffold.
He advised me to stop your messing round the church during these excavations. Thinks you're liable to do yourself an injury.
And how did he know I was messing round the church? I wanted to ask. The answer was obvious. His toady, Marmaduke Pa, had told him.
It's not only that, Father went on. As you very well know, a murder has been committed in the crypt.
I offered up a small prayer of thanks. At least it hadn't been Inspector Hewitt who had rung up, ordering me to keep away. Did he mention poor Mr. Callicutt? The Chancellor, I mean.
As it happens,
Father answered,
he did not. But nevertheless, I want you to stay.
Mrs. Richardson fainted at the altar, I put in before he could say another word. She mistook me for her daughter, Hannah. Father looked up at me, his face harshly lined in the cold moonlight. He had not shaved, and the stubble of his whiskers glittered cruelly. Never had he looked so old. The vicar told me about her, I said,
I didn't ask.
The kitchen clock ticked. Father let out a long sigh.
I can't see you, he said after a while. My eyes are not what they once were. Bring a candle from the pantry. Don't put on the electric light.
I fetched a pewter candlestick and a box of wooden matches, and a minute later, by the flickering light of a wax candle, we were facing each other across the kitchen table.
Denwin and Cynthia have not had the easiest of lives, Father said.
No, I replied. I was learning that the best conversations consisted of keeping quiet and listening, and speaking, when one spoke at all, in words of a single syllable.
He blames himself,
we both said at the same time. It was incredible. Father and I had spoken the same three words at the same instant, as if we were reciting in unison. I did not dare smile.
Yes,
we both said. It was downright eerie. Father had only talked to me, really talked, I mean, on one other occasion, which was the time he was incarcerated in a jail cell in Hindley, charged with the murder of Horace Bonepenny. On that day, he had talked, and I had listened. Now both of us were speaking at the same time.
It was an accident, pure and simple, or at least as pure and simple as any accident can be. Tragic.
Still,
in the circumstances, there was nothing for it but to get on with things. There was a war on. Everybody, in one way or another, was suffering loss. It was a bad time to be deprived of a little girl.
Were you here when it happened? I asked, shocking myself. Where did the sudden boldness come from? A shadow crossed Father's face. The kitchen clock ticked on.
No,
he said after a moment.
I wasn't.
He had, as I well knew, been with Dogger in a prisoner of war camp. It was not a topic of discussion at Buckshaw. How odd, I thought. Here were these four great grievers, Father, Dogger, the Vicar, and Cynthia Richardson, each locked in his or her own past, unwilling to share a morsel of their anguish, not even with one another. Was sorrow, in the end, a private thing, a closed container, something that, like a bucket of water, could be borne only on a single pair of shoulders? To make matters worse, there was the fact that the entire village was sheltering each of them in a cocoon of silence. Those dear, damned people, both the blessers and the blessed. I felt the color rising in my face as I remembered that I had vowed to place flowers publicly on Hannah Richardson's grave. But I would not trouble Father by telling him that. He had enough to worry about.
What are we going to do with you?
He asked suddenly. I don't know, sir, I replied. The sir came out of nowhere. I had never addressed my father in that way before, but it seemed perfectly the right thing to do. It's just that sometimes, I think that I am very like my mother. There, I had said it. I could only wait now to see what damage I had done.
You are not like your mother, Flavia.
I gulped at the blow.
You are your mother.
My mind was a swarm, a beehive, a tornado, a tropical storm. Were my ears actually hearing this? For the past several years, my sisters had increasingly tried to convince me that I was adopted, a changeling, a lump of coal left by a cruel Father Christmas in their stockings.
I've been meaning to talk to you about this for some time, Father said, fidgeting as if he were looking for something lost in the pockets of his dressing gown. I may as well come straight to the point.
My chin was trembling. What was going to happen? What was he going to say? Was he about to tear a strip off me for ruining my best coat?
I am aware that your life has not always been... He began unexpectedly. That is to say, I know that you sometimes...
He looked at me in misery, his face flickering in the candlelight.
Damn it all, he said.
He began again.
As was your mother, you have been given the fatal gift of genius. Because of it, your life will not be an easy one, nor must you expect it to be. You must remember always that great gifts come at great cost. Are there any questions?
Dear father, even the most tender of his moments was a parade square lecture. How I loved him. No, sir, I said, as if I were a sapper being charged with blowing up the enemy lines. No questions.
Very good, very good, father said, standing up and rubbing his hands together. Well then, you'd better get some sleep.
And with that, he was gone, leaving me alone at the table. I thought over all that he had said. His remarks about Harriet were not the sorts of things one ponders at a kitchen table. I needed to review them later, in the privacy of my room, in the comfort of my bed. One thing, though, was clear. Father had not expressly forbidden me to go near the church. Chapter 15.
They say he's bleeding, 'cause his bones has been bothered.
Mrs. Mullet ladled another dollop of her lava-like porridge into my bowl. Thoughts of being an Oliver Twist in reverse crossed my mind.
Please, ma'am, I don't want any more. Eat it up, dear, while it's hot. There's a good girl. Remember, Margaret Mullet tells no fibs. Up porridge sticks to the ribs. Here, I'm a poet and I don't know it.
She giggled at her own wit. The very thought of this grey guck sticking to my ribs, or anything else, was enough to make my stomach go into hibernation.
Thank you, Mrs. M, I said groggily, adding a generous slosh of milk to the oatmeal.
Perhaps I could sip away at the liquid and leave the quivering horror hidden beneath the surface like the Loch Ness Monster.
I barely slept and wasn't at my best.
The cleaning of my coat had been more chemically complicated than I had supposed, and had, in the end, required me to duplicate Michael Faraday's famous 1821 experiment, in which he had synthesized tetrachloroethylene by extracting it, by thermal decomposition, from hexachloroethane. Consequently, I had been up all night.
Actually, his bones haven't been disturbed, I told her. They haven't dug that deep yet.
Well, he blooming well knows they're on their way, Mrs. Mullet said. Mark my words, saints aren't like your ordinary people. They knows things. They can see and hear things at a distance, just like the television. They hear when Mrs. Frampton is praying to have her Elsie's Bert win the pools so she can send her mother to Blackpool on holiday come June, and get her out of her hair for a fortnight so she can scrub the floors and beat the rugs. Mind you, I've said nothing.
I was eating breakfast in the kitchen because, by the time I dragged myself out of bed, Mrs. Mullet had already cleared the table in the dining room.
I heard all about it from my friend Mrs. Waller. She says there was blood all over the place, like an abattoir.
There wasn't all that much, I said. I saw it myself.
Mrs. Mullet's eyes widened.
No more than a couple of teaspoonsful if you collected it all together. Blood always seems greater in volume than it actually is.
If it was blood, in fact.
I could hardly wait to get upstairs to my laboratory and analyze the residue of the stuff into which I had dipped my white ribbon.
Still and all, she said, Miss Tanty had to be put to bed and the doctor called. A real fright she had, babbling on about Mr. Cullycut and the four horsemen of the pocket lips. Made no sense at all. Shock, if you ask me.
I think you're quite right, Mrs. M, I said, my plans changing even as I spoke. I'll take her some flowers. I'll tell her they're from all of us here at Buckshaw. That would be nice, dear, Mrs. Mullet said. You're always such a thoughtful child. Of course I was a thoughtful child. If Miss Tanty's lips had been loosened by laudanum, I wanted to be among the first to hear what came spilling out. Miss Tanty lived in a small house on the west side of Cater Street, which ran north from the High Street, just west of the 13 Drakes. I pulled up and parked Gladys at the gate just as Miss Gall, the treasurer of the Altar Guild, was coming out the front door.
I'm afraid she can't see anyone, child. Doctor's orders. Here, give me those flowers. I'll put them in a vase and bring them round later.
I knew she wouldn't. She would toss them out her back door and onto the rubbish heap. Not that it mattered. I had picked the wild bouquet in the same spot in front of the church as I had the first lot.
That's very kind of you, Miss Gall, I said, handing over the flowers and pulling a look of worried concern down over my face like a balaclava. How is she?
She's resting comfortably now, she replied, but she mustn't be disturbed. We've given her an injection to help her sleep.
We've given her an injection. And then I remembered. Of course, Miss Gall was the retired district nurse, which was why she had used the word injection. Anyone else would have said, we've given her something to help her sleep, or given her a sedative to help her sleep. And they wouldn't have said we. They would have said, the doctor's given her something to help her sleep. What wonderful things can be deduced from a simple four-letter word. I gave the woman my best village idiot grin.
I'd best be getting along then, I said, resisting the urge to add, to the Easter cow show.
There is a limit even to sauciness. I wheeled Gladys along toward the place where the street ended at the river. With elaborate stupidity, I picked up a handful of pebbles and, with tongue hanging out of the corner of my mouth, skipped them across the water's surface. One, two, three. When I looked back, Miss Gall was gone. I walked quickly back to Miss Tanty's house, looked both ways to be sure that no one was in sight, then opened the door and slipped inside. The place was overheated, sweltering like a tropical jungle. On the right was a dining room with an oversized table and more chairs than we had in all of Buckshaw. To the left, a drawing room come music room with all the usual fittings, small grand piano, music stands, plaster busts of Beethoven and Mozart, and another I didn't recognize. Aha, Wagner. His name was engraved on the base. All three of them as cold-looking as if they had been molded from moon rubble. Beyond the study was a small conservatory, overflowing with exotic-looking plants. A parrot sat hunched in an elaborate wire cage.
Pretty, Polly, I said, trying to make friends.
The parrot gave me a surly look.
Who's a pretty bird, then? I asked, feeling like a fool.
But there are only so many topics of conversation one can have with a bird. The thing ignored me.
Perhaps it was hungry.
Perhaps Miss Tanty had been so disturbed that she had forgotten to feed it. I took hold of a chunk of suet which was jammed between the wires of the cage. The bird made a sudden lunge and I jerked back my hand before I lost a finger. I'm afraid I called Polly a nasty name.
Starve, then,
I told it, and turned back to the front entrance. The kitchen, at the back of the house, was the source of the high temperature. A great black stove was throwing off as much heat as the Queen Elizabeth's boilers, and the smell of cooking filled the air. I opened the largest oven and peered inside. An enormous roast of beef was basking in a bed of potatoes, carrots, onions, swedes, and apples. The meat was well browned. It had been baking for at least an hour. Miss Gall had said Miss Tanty was resting, which probably meant upstairs. I returned to the front hall. Hello, Quentin,
the parrot said conversationally from the conservatory. The stupid thing had probably realized I'd intended to feed it and was now trying to suck up to me, but it was too late. Forgiveness is not one of my better qualities. To my left, the stairs had been painted to resemble the keys of a piano, the treads black and every riser white. I climbed slowly up the sloping keyboard, glancing as I went at each of the many black-framed photographs which crowded the walls on both sides. A younger Miss Tanti singing on stage in a long evening gown, her hands clasped at her ample waist. Miss Tanti being given a trophy by a sour gentleman whose expression indicated that he thought someone else should have been the winner. Miss Tanti standing in front of a medieval half-timbered house that looked as if it might be somewhere in Germany. Miss Tanti conducting a choir of girls, all of them, including Miss Tanti herself, dressed in school uniform of jumper, blouse, and black stockings. Miss Tanti, front and center in the choir stalls of St. Tancred's, to one side, the back of Mr. Corlicut's blonde, curly hair just visible as he sits at the organ console. High in the background, just out of focus, is the carved wooden face of St. Tancred. He is not bleeding. At the top of the stairs, I turned to my right and made for the room at the front of the house. Miss Tanti would never settle for a back bedroom. Most of the doors were standing open. Only one, the bedroom at the very front of the house, was closed. I twisted the knob and stuck my nose round the door. Hands crossed on her breast, the mountainous Miss Tanti was lying motionless on the bed. Although her thick spectacles were perched on her nose, her eyes were closed. I tiptoed across the room. It worried me somewhat that she was not snoring. Miss Tanti struck me as the kind of person who did nothing by halves, and I guessed that she was not likely a quiet sleeper. But then, perhaps, trained singers were taught to control their uvulas, those little fingers of flesh that dangle like pink icicles at the back of one's throat, even when they were asleep.
Was Miss Tanti asleep? Or had someone done her in? Had Mr. Collicut's killer returned for a repeat performance? Was someone killing choirs, one musician at a time? Would Feely be next?
All of these thoughts were milling round in my mind at the same time. I had already spotted the dark bottle that stood on top of an overflowing bookcase, which was wedged between the bed and the wall. I was leaning across the bed for a closer look, when one of Miss Tanti's eyes came slowly open. I almost swallowed my tongue. Magnified by the thick lenses, her watery eye was as large as the sudden rising of a bloodshot harvest moon. She blinked and the other eye came open, which was even more alarming than the first. Her pupils swiveled, floating in their soupy liquid, and settled on me. She seemed not at all surprised to see me. It was almost as if she had been waiting.
I let myself in to see if you were all right, I said. I was worried about you.
Miss Tanti's substantial body began shaking with silent tremors, beginning with her shoulders and her ample breasts and working their way down to vanish at her ankles. It reminded me, if only for an instant, of one of Mrs. Mallet's failed gelatin aspics.
Did you? She said, and it was not a question.
It took me a moment to realize that she was laughing. As her cheeks convulsed, she bit her bottom lip, and her great, wet eyes thrashed about in their sockets. It was a gruesome spectacle.
Oh, she said, did you indeed?
She rolled over toward the night table and picked up the bottle. She worked the cork out with her thumbs and poured an inch of reddish-brown liquid into a handy glass.
For my vocal cords, she said,
and tossed it back with a single gulp. She made a token gargling noise as if to convince me. I recognized at once the smell of sherry. Mrs. Mallet used it in Christmas pudding, as well as in what she called her sinful stew. The vocal folds must be rewarded now and then, Miss Tanti said, shoving the cork back into the bottle. They must be treated like trained lions, the frequent whip tempered with the occasional reward.
Could this be the Miss Tanti who had to be put to bed and the doctor called? The Miss Tanti who had been given an injection to help her sleep? If that were true, she was the second woman in Bishop's Lacey within a remarkably short time to require the needle. The first had been Cynthia Richardson, who'd had a fright in the churchyard, and now Miss Tanti, who'd had a fright in the church itself. The same Miss Tanti who was now treating her vocal folds to a second slug of sherry. I'm sorry to walk in without an invitation, I said, without mentioning Miss Gall. I knew what a great shock you'd had with the blood in the church and so forth. I wanted to...
Codswallop, she said, fixing me with her swivel eyes. I was no more shocked than you were.
But... The woman was laughing again, her flesh forming white caps.
Of course, I went to great pains to put it about that I was. A few words babbled from the Book of Revelation can be remarkably convincing. Well, not so much great pains when you come right down to it. In any village, a single telephone call is as good as a leader in the times.
But it was a performance, dear girl, a performance, and a magnificent one, if I do say so myself.
I was especially pleased that even you were taken in by it.
Forgive me, oh Lord. You were quite taken in, weren't you? Admit it. And I must say that crossing myself with the drippings, as it were, was a touch of sheer genius. Although I must tell you that I thought for a few moments you had seen through me.
My mind was racing in circles. I felt like the last to cross the line in a sack race. This horrid old woman had beaten me at my own game.
Taken in by it, I managed.
Of course I wasn't taken in by it. That's why I'm here. It was a feeble recovery, but the best I could do under the circumstances.
Miss Tanti's heaving billows had by now worked themselves up into a full-fledged tropical storm.
Dear me,
she said, removing her spectacles and mopping at her streaming eyes with the corner of a mauve sheet.
Dear me!
Why, she asked, waving a hand at the bookcase, should we leave all the glory of detection to Miss What's-Her-Name? And I noticed for the first time that her library consisted of nothing but green-covered paperback mysteries, like the ones Daffy kept hidden away from prying eyes at the back of her knickers drawer.
I've always fancied myself a more than intelligent woman, Miss Tanti went on. Not brilliant, but not half bad. I'm always the first to work out who put the poison plums into the Christmas pudding, who left the backwards footprints in the paddock, that sort of thing. Much like you, she added, with a withering and focused glare.
My heart sank. I had a rival.
There we were, the three of us, detecting away like billy-ho, and no one the wiser.
The three of us? What was the woman talking about?
I was first out of the gate, I believe, Miss Tanti said. I was on my knees and had a sample of the red stuff, as I believe Jack the Ripper called it, on my finger, on my collar. And you'll have to admit it was a master stroke, Flavia, in the sign of the cross on my forehead.
Blast the woman!
The man Sowerby almost beat me to it with his handkerchief. His tasting the stuff was a nice touch, although a trifle showy. And then, of course, there was you dipping your white ribbon, hoping desperately that no one would notice.
Blast the woman again!
Like three great sleuths we were, thrown together unexpectedly over a pool of blood at the scene of a crime. What a tableau it was! What an immortal moment! What a snapshot for a book's dust jacket!
I wished I'd brought my Kodak.
Now here was a fine kettle of fish. I suppose I should have been happy to find a kindred soul in Bishop's Lacey. But I was not. Far from it. How could I hope to get to the bottom of Mr. Callicutt's unfortunate demise with someone like Miss Tanty muddying the waters? To say nothing of the police.
We could form a type of club, she went on with increasing enthusiasm. Call ourselves the Big Three, or a corporation. TSD, we shall name it. Tanty, Sowerby, and Duluth. With an ampersand, of course.
That did it. I was not going to spend the rest of my hard-earned life playing third fiddle to a couple of amateurs. Or were they? Miss Tanty had raised an interesting point. I had completely overlooked Adam Sowerby. I closed my eyes and tried to visualize his business card. What had it said? Adam Tradescant Sowerby, M.A., F.R. Hort S., etc., Flora Archaeologist, Seeds of Antiquity, Cuttings, Inquiries, Tower Bridge, London, E1TN, Royal, 1066. Inquiries. I had missed that. Drat and double drat. The man was a private detective, which put a whole new light on things. How much, for instance, did he already know about the death of Mr. Callicutt? And how was I going to worm it out of him? Miss Tanty, too, if she had been snooping round the village in search of clues, might well be an even richer source of information than I had imagined. I would need to remain on best of terms with her, at least for now. I've already heard, of course, I said, of how you solved the case of the missing knitting needles. Mrs. Mallet had told us the story as she served the fish. Mind the bones, she had said, and then she had told us about the village mystery solved. It's true, Miss Tanty was saying, preening a little. Poor Mrs. Lucas, she was so distray. Couldn't for the life of her. Where had she left her knitting needles? They had completely vanished, you see, in a flash. Have you looked in your hair? I asked her. She's always worn her hair bunched up in a great knot, like those dreadful dancers in Toulouse-Lautrec, La Goulou, and so forth, the Queen of Montmartre. Mrs. Lucas gave me ever so odd a look, and reached up, and lo and behold, she had shoved them without thinking into her coiffure when the postman came to the gate. You're a regular Sherlock Holmes, you are, she told me. I gave Miss Tanty a professional, courteous smile. About Mr. Callicutt, I began. But there was no need to prime this pump. One touch of the handle and the whole story came gushing out. It was on a Tuesday, she said, the Tuesday before Ash Wednesday, to be precise. It's always so lovely to be precise, isn't it, dear? One finds it so helpful when one is involved in the art of pervigilation. Get on with it, I wanted to shout, but I had to be on my best behavior. I gave Miss Tanty a weak smile. The Tuesday before Ash Wednesday, as I have reason to recall, since we were going to be singing the Shio setting of the Benedicte the next morning at Matins. We have been working it up for some time. But as your sister Ophelia will tell you, it's a fiendishly difficult piece. It sounds easy, I know, as all great music does, but it is, in fact, a trap and a snare for the unwary. Because I had not had sufficient time to master the score, odd, isn't it, how printed music is called a score, as if it were a game of cricket, which, I suppose, in a way it is, runs and so forth. I knew that I should have to rely upon my sight-reading ability, which is generally considered by those who have witnessed it to be quite remarkable. The only difficulty, the fly in the ointment, if you will, was the fact that my eyes had been playing up.
There were times, especially times of great emotion, when the notes on the page were little more than a wretched blur. I knew that either my lenses or my medication needed to be adjusted post-haste, and hence my appointment with the good Mr. Gideon in Hindley. Usually, whenever I found it necessary to make the pilgrimage, as I like to call it, Mildred Battle was kind enough to run me over in her Austin. A regular saint she is. A most appropriate conductor to one on a pilgrimage, don't you think? I smiled dutifully. But on the morning itself, her niece, Florence, rang me up before breakfast. Auntie Mildred's sick, she said. It must have been something she ate. Oh dear, I told her. I'm sorry to hear that. I shall have to telephone for Clarence Mundy's taxicab, although I shudder to think of the cost of keeping him waiting all day in Hindley. I suppose I ought to have been more sensitive to Mildred's predicament, but there it is. I suppose I was thinking of the keen disappointment of the parishioners, and yes, the vicar too, should I be unable to lend my voice to the Benedicte. You do see my dilemma, don't you? I said that I did. But don't worry, Florence said almost before the words were out of my mouth. Mr. Collicutt's offered to drive you, and Auntie Mildred's kindly agreed to let him take her car. He'll pick you up at 9:25. I had forgotten that Mr. Collicutt lodged with Mr. and Mrs. Battle. Thank goodness Miss Tanty had reminded me. That made two more people, three, counting Florence, the niece, to be questioned. Which couldn't have been more perfect, Miss Tanty went on. My appointment with Mr. Gideon was set for 9:30, and although it's only a 10 or 15 minute drive to Hindley, I always like to be well ahead of the clock. Sometimes, if one is early, and there should happen to be a cancellation, they'll take one before one's time, and one will be home all that much earlier and save 3 shillings in the bargain. I shall be waiting at the gate, I told Florence, and so I was. When Mr. Collicutt hadn't arrived by 9 o'clock, I tried to ring Florence back, but the line was engaged. Miss Goulard at the telephone exchange said that as there were no voices on the line, someone had likely left the receiver off its cradle. I was beside myself, I can tell you. But when I tried again at 15:15, the call went through with no trouble at all. Florence picked up at once and told me that Mr. Collicutt had left the house at 8:30. I was furious, I can tell you. I could have killed the man. I must have looked shocked. Miss Tanty flustered. A figure of speech, of course. I'd no more kill dear Mr. Collicutt, or anyone else, of course, than sprout wings and fly. Surely you know that. Of course, I said, suddenly wary of the woman. Dear Mr. Collicutt, could this be the same Miss Tanty who had told me not to waste my crocuses? There was something strange at work here, and it wasn't love. He was a very competent musician, she went on, but like all competent musicians, he tended to overwork himself. If he wasn't teaching his private pupils, or working with the choir, or off adjudicating one music festival or another, he was in the throes of composition. Mildred says she and George used to hear him pacing back and forth in his room overhead, no matter the time of night. They'd have had words with him if it weren't for the fact that they needed the money. Lodgers are not as easy to find as they were during the war, but one that creeps out to go walking in the dark of the moon is surely a sore trial to a stonemason who works long, hard hours and has to be up before the crack of dawn. The dark of the moon? I asked. Why would he do that? Restlessness, I suppose. Working out harmonies and counterpoint in his head. I know that he sometimes went to the church. At times, when the wind was in the west, I would catch snatches of organ music at odd hours. I more than once thought of taking the dear man a thermos flask of hot tea, but I hated to intrude. Music can be such a harsh mistress, you know. She fixed me with a gigantic eye. Was she trying to extract information? Mistresses were a topic Daffy had sometimes spoken of, but they did not hold the same interest for me as they did her. Unless there was murder involved, or poison, such as in the case of Madame de Brinvillet and the Chevalier de Saint Croix, I didn't give a fig what people got up to in their spare time.
I sometimes walk in the darkness myself, Miss Tanti was saying, even though the night air is said by some to be deleterious to the voice. One simply walks with one's mouth closed, breathing calmly through one's nose.
I shuddered at the very thought of Miss Tanti drifting about the village in the darkness with her mouth closed, breathing calmly through her nose. No wonder people claim to have seen ghosts. Those mysterious lights the ARP members and the fire watchers had seen floating in the churchyard during the war were probably, in reality, no more than the glinting of the moon off Miss Tanti's gigantic lenses. Or were they something far more sinister? I'd better be getting along, I said. I'll see myself out.
I'm relieved to hear that you're all right, Miss Tanti.
This shameless toadying was like playing the game even after the last seats in the pavilion had emptied. But my seeming generosity of spirit would leave the door open for later questioning, should it be necessary.
Think about what I said, Miss Tanti called out when I was already at the door. The three of us, with our heads together, would be a force to be reckoned with.
I gave her a noncommittal smile and started down the stairs, past the musical portrait gallery. I paused for a moment to have a second squint at the vinegarish gentleman presenting Miss Tanti with the music trophy. I had seen his face somewhere before, but I couldn't for the life of me remember where. Just for fun, I jumped down the last three steps and landed on my feet with a bang in the foyer.
Geronimo! I shouted.
It was a battle cry made famous by the American paratroopers, or so Carl Pendraka had told me. To my right, in the drawing room, a man standing at Miss Tanti's desk straightened with a jerk and spun round in surprise. He had been rifling through her papers. It was Adam Sowerby. He stared for no more than a split second before a broad grin began spreading across his face.
By Jove, he said, caught in the act. You gave me a jolly good start.
You're a private detective, I said.
Well, he replied, I shall have to admit that there are certain aspects of my career which do not involve gillyflowers.
You're a private detective, I repeated.
I was not going to be circumlocuted, or whatever the word was. I would have to ask Daffy.
Yes, since you put it that way, yes.
I thought as much, I said. It's printed on your card. Inquiries.
Very astute of you.
Please don't condescend to me, Mr. Sowerby. I'm not a child. Well, actually, strictly speaking, and in the eyes of the law, I suppose I am a child, but still, I resent being treated like one.
I shall throw myself prostrate before you and weep hot tears into the carpet,
he said with a grin, waving his arms like a madman. I marched toward the door.
Flavia, wait!
I stopped.
Sorry, it's hard to quit being an ass in an instant. Rather like running a motor car off the road and into a hayfield, it takes a few yards to come to a halt.
Perhaps we should step outside, I said, before Miss Tanti comes downstairs and finds you burglarizing her belongings.
Good Lord, he said. You mean to say she's at home?
Upstairs, I said, pointing with my chin.
Then it's exeunt omnes for us,
he whispered, putting a long forefinger to his lips and taking high, exaggerated steps toward the door like a black-masked housebreaker in the pantomime.
You really are silly, I told him. I wish you'd stop.
Chapter 16. We were standing on the riverbank at the end of Cater Street, well away from Miss Tanti's ears. We had walked there in total silence. Now, the only sound was that of the running river and the muted muttering of a few ducks that paddled round in circles on the current.
"I'm sorry," he repeated. "Old habits die hard."
"Is that part of your cover?" I asked. "Being an ass?" I had heard the term cover used in one of the Philip O'Dell mysteries on the BBC Wireless. The Case of the Curious Queen, if I remembered correctly. It meant pretending to be someone else, someone that one wasn't. I had only occasionally had the opportunity to try the technique myself, since nearly everybody in Bishop's Lacey was as well acquainted with Flavia Deluce as they were their own mothers. It was only when I was a safe distance from home that I was able to take on another character.
"I suppose it is," Adam said, giving his nose a twist with his fingers. "There, I have switched it off. I am quite myself again."
His grin was gone, and I took him at his word. "Miss Tanti thinks we should join forces," I told him. "Form some sort of detection club."
"Share information?" Adam asked.
"Well, yes, I suppose that's what she was getting at."
"I wasn't aware of her detective aspirations," he said. "Perhaps I should have been, which means, of course, that that ghastly performance in the church yesterday was all a sham, as was her well-advertised breakdown this morning. Very clever of you to have spotted it."
"I didn't spot it," I said. "She confessed before I was halfway in the door."
"But why?"